275 and 285. Also in stereo on VHF. This is National Radio 1. Well, hello there. This is TV on the Radio, Thomas Vance, and welcome to the Friday Rock Show. Pigs on the Wing, Part 1 from Animals by the Pink Floyd, their album that came out in 1977. Now, tonight we're going to repeat The Wall. It's a program that was built around the follow-up to Animals that we originally broadcast on the 30th of November last year. Now, during that month, I flew over to Hollywood for 2 days to hear the double album and talk to Roger Waters about its creation. We actually met in a bedroom at the Beverly Hills Hotel. We ordered a few beers, we sat down with a tape recorder, and we talked about the double album track by track. Now, the first question I asked Roger referred to the origination of the concept of The Wall. Just where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea for The Wall came from 10 years of touring with rock shows. I think, particularly the last few years, when in 75 and in 77 we were playing to very large audiences, some of whom were our old audience who'd come to hear what we wanted to play, but most of whom were only there for the beer in big stadiums, and consequently it became rather an alienating experience doing the shows. And I became very conscious of a wall between us and our audience. And so this record started out as being an expression of those feelings.
But it goes, I think, a little bit deeper than that, because the record actually seems to start at the beginning of the character's life.
The story has been developed considerably since then. This was 2 years ago. I started to write it. And now it's partly about a show situation, a live show situation. In fact, the album starts off in a live show. And then it flashes back and traces a story of a character, if you like, of Pink himself, whoever he may be. But initially it was just stemmed from shows being horrible.
When you say horrible, do you mean that... really, you didn't want to be there?
Yeah. It's all partially because the people who you're most aware of at a rock show when you're on the stage are the front 20 or 30 rows of bodies. And in large situations where you're using what's euphemistically called festival seating, they tend to be packed together, swaying madly. And it's very difficult to perform in those situations of people whistling and shouting and screaming and throwing things and hitting each other and crashing about and letting off fireworks and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, having a wonderful time, but it's a drag to try and play when all that's going on. But I felt at the same time that it's a situation that we'd created ourselves through our own greed. You know, if you play very large venues, the only real reason for playing very large venues is to make money.
But surely, in your case, it wouldn't be economic or feasible to play a small venue.
Well, it would. It's not going to be on when we do this show, because this show is going to lose money. But on those tours that I'm talking about, the 75 tour of Europe and England and the 77 tour of Europe, England and America as well, we were making money. We made a lot of money on those tours because we were playing big venues.
What would you like the audience to do? How would you like the audience to react to your music?
I'm actually happy that they do whatever they feel is necessary, because they're only expressing, you know, their response to what it's like. In a way, I'm saying that they're right, you know, that those shows are bad news.
Mm.
There is an idea, or there has been an idea for many years abroad, that it's a very uplifting and wonderful experience, and that there's a great contact between the audience and the performers on the stage. And I think that that is not true. I think that in very many cases, it's actually a rather alienating experience.
For the audience?
For everybody.
It's 2.5 years since you had an album out. I think people would be interested in knowing how long it's taken you to develop this double album?
Right, well, we toured. We did a tour which ended, I think, in July or August of 77. And when we finished that tour, in the autumn of that year, that's when I started writing it. It took me a year, no, until the next July, working on my own, and then I had a demo, sort of 90 minutes of stuff, which I played to the rest of the guy, and then we all started working on it together in the October or November of that. October 78, we started working on it together.
And you actually ceased recording, I think, in November of this year.
Yeah. We didn't start recording in November. We didn't start recording until the new year, till April this year. But we were rehearsing and fiddling about with it and obviously rewriting a lot. So it's taken a long time, but we always tend to work very slowly anyway, because it's difficult.
The first track is In the Flesh.
Yeah.
This actually sets up what the character has become.
Yes.
At the end.
Couldn't have put it better myself. It's a reference back to our 1977 tour, which was called Pink Floyd In the Flesh.
And then you have a track called The Thin Ice.
Yeah.
Now, this is, I think, at the very, very beginning of the character. Call the character Pink.
Right.
The very beginning of Pink's life.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. In fact, at the end of In the Flesh, you hear somebody shouting, roll the sound effects, and you hear the sound of bombers. So it gives you some indication of what's happening. In the show, it'll be much more obvious what's going on. So it's a flashback, and we start telling a story, which, in terms of this, it's about my generation.
The war.
Yeah, war babies. But it could be about anybody who gets left by anybody, if you like.
Did that happen to you?
Yeah, my father was killed in the war.
About the father who's gone.
Yeah.
Though the father in the album has flown across the ocean.
Yeah.
Now, the assumption from listening to that would be that he's gone away to somewhere else.
Yeah, well, it could be. You see, it works on various levels. It doesn't have to be about the war. I mean, I think it could, you know, it should work for any generation, really. The father is also, I'm the father as well, you know. People who leave their families to go and work, not that I leave my family to go and work, but lots of people do and have done. So it's not meant just to be a simple story about, you know, somebody getting killed in the war and growing up and going to school, blah, 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 but about being left more generally.
The Happiest Days of Our Lives is a complete condemnation, as I see it, as I've heard it in the album, of somebody's scholastic career.
Mm. Well, my school life was very like that. Mm. It was awful. It was really terrible. When I hear people whining on now about bringing back grammar school, it really makes me quite ill to listen to it. Because I went to a boys' grammar school, and although... I want to make it plain that some of the men who taught in it was a boys' school. Some of the men who taught there were very nice guys. You know, I'm not. It's not meant to be a blanket condemnation of all teachers everywhere. But the bad ones can really do people in. And there were some at my school who were just incredibly bad and treated the children so badly. Just putting them down. Just putting them down, putting them down, putting them down, you know, all the time. Never encouraging them to do things. Not really trying to interest them in anything. Just trying to keep them quiet and still and crush them into the right shape so that they would go on to university and do well.
The track Mother. What sort of a mother is this mother?
Overprotective, which most mothers are. If you can level one accusation at mothers, it is that they tend to protect their children too much. Too much and for too long. That's all. This isn't a portrait of my mother. Although some of the, you know, one or two of the things in there apply to her as well as to, I'm sure, lots of other people's mouths. But funnily enough, lots of people recognise that.
Mm.
And in fact, a woman that I know the other day who'd heard the album called me up and said she liked it. And she said that listening to that track had made her feel very guilty. She's got sort of three kids, and I wouldn't have said that she was particularly overprotective towards her children. But I was interested that it, you know, she's a woman of, well, my age. And I was interested that it had got through. So I was glad it had, you know. I mean, if it means that much to people, I think that's good.
Track Goodbye Blue Sky.
Mm.
What is actually happening at this stage in Pink's life?
Since we compiled the album, I haven't really clearly tried to think my way through it, but I know that this area is very confusing. I think the best way to describe this is as a recap, if you like, of side one. This is the start of side two. And you could look upon Goodbye Blue Sky as a recap of side one. So, yes, it's remembering one's childhood and then getting ready to set off into the rest of one's life.
Then comes the track, What Shall We Do Now? Is this, the assumption would be this is when the emergent adult...
That's right. Now, that's the track that is not on the album.
Right.
It was quite nice. In fact, I think we'll do it in the show. But if you know, this, it's quite long, and this side was too long, and there was too much of it. It's the same tune as Empty Spaces, and we've put Empty Spaces where What Shall We Do Now is.
Because without those words, listening to the album...
Yeah, it makes less sense.
Well, it's not so much that it makes less sense. It just means that there is a period in Pink's life that isn't indicated. I mean, he jumps from the recap of side one immediately into Young Lust.
Right. No, he doesn't. He goes to Empty Spaces. And the lyrics there are very similar to the first four lines of What Shall We Do Now?
Mm.
But what's different, really, is this list. Shall we buy a new guitar, drive a more powerful car, work right through the night, you know, and all that stuff.
Give up meat, rarely sleep, keep people as pets.
Right. It's just about the ways that one protects oneself from one's isolation by becoming obsessed with other people's ideas. Whether the idea is that it's good to have a powerful car, you know, that'll make you, or whether you're obsessed with the idea of being a vegetarian, adopting somebody else's criteria for yourself without considering them from a position of really being yourself. On this level, the story is extremely simplistic. I hope that on other levels there are, you know, less tangible, more effective things that come through.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's okay in a show where you only hear the words. We probably won't hear the words at all. The way rock and roll shows get produced.
But they're there on the sleeve if you need them.
Yeah. That's why we didn't go into a great panic about trying to change all the inner bags and things. I think it's important that they're there so that people can read. But equally, I think it's important that people know why they're there. Otherwise, I agree, it's terribly confusing.
And then you come to this track, which is called Young Lust. As far as Pink, the rock and roll star...
Yeah,
Roger Waters, the writer. I mean, was there ever a Young Lust section of your life?
Well, yes. I suppose actually, yes, it did happen to me. That was like me a few years ago. But I would never have said it. You see, I'd never have actually come out with anything like that.
Mm.
I was much too frightened. When I wrote this song, Young Lust, the words were all quite different. It was about leaving school and wandering around town and hanging around outside porno movies and dirty bookshops and things like that, and being very interested in sex but never actually being able to get involved because of being too frightened, really. Now it's completely different. That was a function of us all working together on the record, particularly with Dave Gilmour and Bob Ezrin. We co-produced it together, the three of us co-produced the album. Young Lust is a pastiche, number it. It reminds me very much of a song we recorded years and years ago called The Nile Song. It's very similar. Dave sings it in a very similar way. I think he sings Young Lass terrific. I love the vocal on it. But it's meant to be a pastiche of just any young rock and roll band out on the road. It's great. I love that operator. I think she's wonderful. She didn't know what was happening at all. The way she picks up on... I mean, it's been edited a bit, but the way she picks up all that stuff about, is there supposed to be anybody else there besides your wife? You know, I think it's amazing. She really clicked into it straight away. She's terrific.
And then comes One of My Turns.
Yeah, so then the idea is that we've leapt somehow a lot of years from Goodbye Blue Sky through What Shall We Do Now, which doesn't exist on the record anymore, and Empty Spaces, into Young Lass. That's like a show. We've leapt into a rock and roll show somewhere on into our hero's career. And then One of My Turns is supposed to be his response to a lot of aggravation in his life and not really ever having got anything together with a woman, although he's been married. He has got things together, but he's been married and he's just splitting up with his wife. And in response, he takes another girl back to his hotel room.
And he really is... He's got everything but nothing.
Yeah. He's had it now. He's definitely going a bit dippy now. And One of My Turns is just, you know, him coming in and he can't relate to this girl either, you know. That's why he just turns on the TV when they come into the room and she starts going on about all the things he's got, and all he does is just turn on the TV and sit there and he won't talk to her.
Then comes a period in Don't Leave Me Now when he realizes the state that he's in.
Yeah.
He still feels, if you like, aggressive and completely depressed, thoroughly paranoid, and very lonely.
Yeah.
But very lonely, to the point of suicide.
Yeah, well, not quite. But yes, it is a very depressing song. I love it. I really like it.
There's this line in the song, to beat you to a pulp on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just... I don't know quite how to phrase that. But it really is the depths, if you like, of deprived depravity.
Well, it's just a lot of men and women do get involved with each other for lots of wrong reasons, and they do get very aggressive towards each other and do each other a lot of damage. I, of course, as far as I can recall, have never struck a woman, Tommy, and I hope I never do, but a lot of people have. And a lot of women have struck men as well. And there is a lot of violence in relationships often that aren't working. I mean, this is obviously an extremely cynical song.
Mm.
I don't feel like that about marriage now.
But you did.
This is one of those difficult things where a small percentage of this is autobiographical, and all of it is rooted in my own experience. But it isn't. This isn't my autobiography.
Mm.
Although it's rooted within my experience, like any writing. Some of it's me, and an awful lot of it is what I've observed.
But there's also a lot of fundamental truth in it.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's what... If you look and if you, you know, see things, and if they ring true, then those are the kinds of things... If you're interested in writing songs or writing books or writing poems or writing anything, those are the things that you try and write down, because those are the things that are interesting, and those are the things that will touch other people, which is what writing's all about, you know, is some people have a need to write down their own feelings in the hope that other people will recognise them and derive some worth from them, whether it's a feeling of, you know, kinship, or whether it makes them happy or sad or whatever, that they will derive something from them.
Another Brick in the Wall, Part 3. I don't need no arms around me. He seems to be in a position whereby he's no longer confused. In other words, he's more confident.
Yes.
But then comes the track Goodbye Cruel World.
Yeah,
now, what is happening there?
Okay. Well, what's happening is, from the beginning of one of my turns, where the door opens there, through to the end of side three, the scenario is an American hotel room. The groupie leaves at the end of one of my turns, and then Don't Leave Me Now, he sings, which is to anybody. It's not to her, it's not really to his wife, it's kind of to anybody, really.
To his circumstances.
Well, it's men to women, in a way, you know. From that kind of feeling, it's like, it's a very kind of guilty song as well. Anyway, at the end of that, then there he is in his room with his TV, and then there's that kind of symbolic TV smashing. And then he resurges a bit out of that kind of violence. And he sings this sort of loud song saying, all in all, you were all just bricks in the wall, I don't need anybody. So he's convincing himself, really, that his isolation is a desirable thing. That's all.
But how is he at that moment of time when he says, goodbye, cruel world, is actually...
That's him going catatonic, if you like. That's the final... You know, he's going right, he's going back, and he's just curling up, and he's not going to move. That's it, he's had enough, that's the end. In the show, we've worked out a very clever mechanical system so that we can complete the wall, or the middle section of the wall, building downwards, so we get left with a sort of triangular-shaped hole that we can fill in bit by bit, rather than filling it in at the top. So we have this enormous wall across the auditorium and we're filling in this little hole at the bottom. And the last brick goes into the wall as he sings goodbye at the end of goodbye. That is the completion of the wall. It's been being built since, in my case, the Second World War, but in anybody else's case, whenever they care to think of it, if they feel isolated or alienated from other people at all, then, you know, it's from wherever you want.
So would it be accurate to say that at that moment of time, he's discovered exactly where he's at?
Yeah.
And the wall is complete. In other words, his character, via all the experiences he's had,
yes,
has finally, in his eyes anyway, yeah, been completed.
Yeah. He's nowhere.
He's absolutely nowhere.
Yeah.
And then comes the beginning of side three, which actually starts with a different song,
yeah,
than on the sleeve.
Yeah. Bob Ezrin called me up and he said, I've just listened to side three and it doesn't work. And in fact, I think I'd been feeling uncomfortable about it anyway. And I thought about it and a couple of minutes I realised that Hey You conceptually could go anywhere and that it would make a much better side if we put Hey You at the front of the side and sandwiched the little theatrical scene with the guy in the hotel room between... an attempt to re-establish contact with the outside world, which is what Hey You is,
mm-hmm,
and the end of the side, which is, well, which we will come to. So that's why those lyrics are printed in the wrong places, because that decision was made very... I should explain at this point, the reason that all these decisions were made so late was because we'd promised lots of people a long time ago that we would finish this record by the beginning of November. And we wanted to keep that promise.
But the guy is now behind the wall.
Yeah. He's behind the wall, A, symbolically, and B, he's locked in a hotel room with a broken window that looks out onto a freeway, motorway.
And now what's he going to do with his life?
Well, he's sort of, within his mind, because Hey You is a...
It's a cry for help.
Yes, it's a cry to the rest of the world saying, hey, you know, this isn't how it should be, really. But it's also, it takes a narrative look at it. When it gets, Dave sings the first two verses of Hey You, and then there's an instrumental passage, and then there's a bit that goes, but it was only fantasy, which I sing, which is the narration of the thing. The wall was too high, as you can see. No matter how he tried, he could not break free, and the worms ate into his brain. The worms, that's the first reference to worms. The worms, worms have a lot less to do with the piece than they did a year ago. A year ago, they were very much a part of it. They were my, if you like, my symbolic representation of decay. Because the basic idea behind the whole thing really is that if you isolate yourself, you decay. So, at the end of Hey You, he makes this cry for help, but it's too late.
Because he's behind the wall.
Yeah, and anyway, he's only singing it to himself. You know, it's no good crying for help if you're sitting in a room all on your own and only saying it to yourself. And all of us, I'm sure, from time to time, have formed sentences in our minds that we would like to say to somebody else, but we don't say it, you know. Well, that's no use. You know, that doesn't help anybody. That's just a game that you play with yourself.
And that's what comes up in the track Nobody Home. The first line being, I've got a little black book with my poems in.
Yes, exactly, precisely, yeah. After Is There Anybody Out There, which is a, really just a mood piece.
So he's sitting in his room, and he's got... It's total realisation, he needs help, but he doesn't know how to get it, really.
No, he doesn't really want it.
Doesn't want it at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, he does, part of him does, but the part of him that's, you know, making his arms and his legs, and part of him that's making everything work doesn't want anything except to just sit there and watch the TV.
But he goes through this whole thing in the track Nobody Home, of all the things that he's got the obligatory Hendrix perm, he's got the strong urge to fly, the wild staring eyes and the silver spoon on the chain, the nicotine stains on the fingers, all the things that we know are pretty real in the world of rock and roll.
There's some lines in here that hark back to the halcyon days of Sid Barrett. Yeah. It's partly about all kinds of people that I've known. All this is about all sorts of people I've known. Hey, but Sid was the only person I ever knew who used elastic bands to keep his boots together, which is where that line comes from. In fact, obviously, the obligatory Hendrix perm, you know, you have to go back 10 years before you can understand what all that's about.
And then he says, I've got fading roots at the very end.
Yeah. Well, he's getting ready to re-establish his contact, if you like, with where he started. And to start making some sense of what it was all about. If you like, he's getting ready here to start getting back to side one.
Which he then does by the next track, which is called Vera.
Yeah,
very much the World War II sort of being born and created, if you like, in that era again. So
this is supposed to be brought on by the fact that a war movie comes on the TV.
Which you can actually hear.
Which you can actually hear, yeah. Mm. Mentioning no titles or names. and that snaps him back to then. And it precedes what, for me anyway, is... Yeah, the central song on the whole album is Bring the Boys Back Home.
Why?
Well, because it's partly about not letting people go off and be killed in wars. But it's also partly about not allowing rock and roll or... an important and jolly boys' game, that it becomes more important than friends, wives, children, people, other people, you know.
Hey, what stage of the game is the character Pink for the track Comfortably Numb?
After Bring the Boys Back Home, there's a short piece where there are tape loops used. There's the teacher's voice heard again, and there's, you can hear the groupies saying, well, are you feeling okay? And there's the operator saying, I can't remember, and it's a man answering all those things. And there's a new voice introduced at that point, and there's somebody knocking on the door and saying, come on, it's time to go. Right. So the idea is that they're coming to get him to take him to the show because he's got to go and perform that night. And they come into the room and they've realised something's wrong And so they actually physically bring the doctor in. And Comfortably Numb is about his confrontation with the doctor.
So the doctor puts him into such a physiological condition that he can actually hit the stage?
Yes. He gives him an injury. In fact, it's very specific, that song.
Just a little pinprick.
Yeah.
There'll be no more ah.
Right. Because they're not interested in any of these problems. All they're interested in is the fact that, you know, there are however many thousand people there are and all the tickets have been sold and the show must go on. At any cost to anybody. I mean, I personally have done gigs under I've been done gigs when I've been very depressed, but I've also done gigs when I've been extremely ill. This, where you wouldn't do any ordinary kind of work.
Because then the venue's there, because yeah. The act's there, and
people have paid the money. You cancel a show at short notice, and it's expensive.
So the fella's back on the stage.
Yeah.
But he's very...
He's
vicious.
Yeah.
I mean, he's...
Well, the idea...
Fascist.
Yes. Well, here's the story. I've just remembered. Montreal, 1977, in the Olympic Stadium, 80,000 people. The last gig of our 1977 tour, I personally became so upset during the show that I spat at some guy in the front row. He was shouting and screaming and having a wonderful time. And they were pushing against the barrier. And, you know, what he wanted was a good riot. And what I wanted was to do a good rock and roll show. And I got so upset that I finally spat on him. And which is a, you know, very nasty thing to do to anybody. Anyway, the idea is that these kind of fascist feelings develop from isolation.
And he evidences this from the focal point of the centre of the stage.
Yeah, this is really him, you know, having a go at the audience, or the minorities in the audience. So the obnoxiousness of In the Flesh, and it is meant to be obnoxious, you know, I mean, it is obnoxious, this is the end result of that much isolation and decay.
In the track Run Like Hell, this is him telling the audience.
No.
Is this him telling himself?
No. Run Like Hell is meant to be him just doing another tune in a show. So that's like just a song.
Part of a performance.
Show, part of a performance, yeah. Still in his drug-crazed state. Run Like Hell. You can hear an audience shouting Pink Floyd on the left-hand side of your stereo, if you're listening in Cairns, and on the right-hand side, or in the middle, you can hear voices going, hammer, they're saying, hammer. This is the Pink Floyd audience, if you like, turning into a rally.
And then comes the track Waiting for the Worms. And the worms, in your mind, are decay. So
yes.
Decay is imminent.
Waiting for the Worms, in theatrical terms, is the expression of what happens in the show when the drugs start wearing off and what real feelings he's got left start taking over again. And he is forced by where he is, because he's been dragged out of the hotel room, if you like, and put in that position, he's forced by the situation he finds him in to confront his real feelings. Until you see either the show or the film of this thing, you won't know why people are shouting hammer, but the hammer, we've used the hammer as a symbol of the forces of oppression, if you like, in the thing. And the worms are the thinking part. Where it goes into the waiting sections.
Waiting for the worms to come, waiting to cut out the dead wood.
Yeah, before it goes waiting to cut out the dead wood, you hear a voice through a loudhailer. It starts off, but it goes testing 1, 2 or something, and then it says, we will convene at 1 o'clock outside Brixton Town Hall. And it's describing the situation of marching towards some kind of National Front rally in Hyde Park, or anybody, I mean, the National Front, and what we have in England, but it could be anywhere in the world. So all that shouting and screaming on it, because you can't hear it, you see. If you listen very carefully, you might hear Lambeth Road, and you might hear Vauxhall Bridge, and you know, and you might hear the words Jew boys or something. We may encounter some Jew boys. It's just me ranting on.
Him on trial.
He does.
He puts himself on trial.
Yes. The idea is that the drugs wear off, and in waiting for the worms, he keeps flipping backwards and forwards from his real, or his original persona, if you like, which is a reasonably kind of humane person, into this waiting for the worms to come persona, which is flipped and is ready to crush anybody or anything that gets in the way. Which is the response to having been badly treated and feeling very isolated. But at the end of waiting for the worms, it gets too much for him, that oppression, and he says, stop. I don't think you can actually hear the word stop on the record, or maybe you can. Anyway, it goes, stop.
Yeah, it's very quick.
Record. Yeah, it's very quick. And then he says, I want to go home, take off his uniform and leave the show. But he says, I'm waiting in this prison cell because I have to know if I've been guilty all this time. So, and then he tries himself, if you like. So the judge is part of him just as much as all the other characters and things that he remembers. They're all in his mind. They're all memories. Anyway, at the end of it all, his judgment on himself is to de-isolate himself, which in fact is a very good thing.
So now it really has turned full circle.
Almost, yeah. That kind of circular idea is expressed in that thing of just snipping a tape at a certain point and sticking a bit on the front, that tune, that this Outside the Wall tune at the end.
So the character in Outside the Wall says, all alone are in twos, the ones who really love you walk up and down outside the wall, some hand in hand, some gathering together in bands. The bleeding hearts of the artists make their stand, and when they've given you their all, some stagger and fall. After all, it's not easy banging your heart against some mad bugger's wall.
Yeah.
And that really is the statement of the album.
Yeah, and which I have no intention of even beginning to explain.
Roger, what will it actually be like when we see the wall in concert?
Just like it normally is for a lot of people, you know, who are all packed away behind PA systems and things. You know, like every seat in the house is sold, so there's always thousands of people over at the sides who can't see anything. Mm-hmm. You know? And very often in rock shows the sound is dreadful because it costs too much to make it really good. In those kind of halls, you know. The sound will be very good, mind you, at these shows, but it'll be the impediments to seeing what's going on and hearing what's going on will be symbolic rather than real.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the wall, which will stop people seeing what's going on.
Is the wall going to remain there?
No, not forever. No, not forever.
Who's going to knock it down?
I think we should wait and see about that. For the live show. I think it would be silly, really, for me to explain to you everything that's going to happen in the live show that we put up. Mind you, anybody with any sense listening to the album ought to be able to spot whereabouts in the show it is that it comes down.
That's the physical wall, though.
Yeah.
What about the psychological wall?
That's another matter. Whether we make any inroads into that or not is anybody's guess. I hope so.
Roger Waters describing The Wall, and the success of the double album since the first broadcast of that program, which of course was last November, is now just a matter of history. The Wall was America's number one LP for 16 weeks. It reached number three over here, and it sold millions of copies worldwide. And of course it spawned the single Another Brick in the Wall that went to number one both here and in America. The stage show has already been performed in Los Angeles and New York, and we in this country are going to have the opportunity to see the live show at London's Earl's Court between the 4th and the 9th of August. At least, those of us who are lucky enough to have tickets. Now, once again, I really would like to thank Roger Waters for his time and to congratulate the Pink Floyd on being awarded the Silver Clef Award for services to the British music industry. And the Friday Rock Show, as always, is produced by Tony Wilson.